You're listening to a 3CR podcast of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia.
City Limits. Brought to us by the People's Committee for Melbourne every Wednesday at 9 a.m.
City Limits is Melbourne's only hour devoted to our urban environment.
To transport and planning and housing issues.
To privatisations and our utility services.
To building and or maintaining a sense of community. 855 on the AM band, if we can hear it through the noise and find it through the smog.
City Limits.
Okay, the Acres and Acres of Tarrant Cement, as we say every week, we've just ridden over them from Brunswick to Collingwood or Fitzroy, wherever we are at the moment. I've got to know where I am. And I'm actually in a studio at 3CR. And Antimony just turned on the panel for us. Thanks for doing the job today. You got, what's that in your hand? Oh, short straw, that's what you caught today, that's right. got that. Inez is helping out as well, and I'm Kevin Healy. It is City Limits. It's a fourth Wednesday, but we're going to be talking today about uranium, because at the moment we know there's lots of threats with bombs flying all over the place and uranium deposits being bombed or near bombed, and the threat that can pose. So we're going to talk to Dave Sweeney, the Australian Conservation Foundation anti-uranium campaigner, about that. And there's another issue that I mentioned in passing last week at Jabiluka. For years, of course, Jabiluka has been closed, the uranium mine up in the Northern Territory. And Rio Tinto, which owns, or the owner, prime owner of ERA, the company which ran Range around Jabiluka, Range are now closed down. Have agreed with the Mirarr people, the local indigenous people who say it should never be opened. But there's a court case taking place where a group is trying to take over ERA, get a majority, and saying that if the ownership changes, then the Mirarr people's objection and the long-term agreement that it will never reopen becomes null and void, and the uranium mine can reopen. So it's a pretty serious situation, and we could, Dave's going to talk to us about that as well. So that's today's program. Up till then, we'll just rave on. We'll have about 9:30 or so. Dave, a cup of tea anyway. People, anyone want a cup of tea? Antimony, three today, and everyone in the studio. We're having a Vietnamese green tea today, if you're interested in what you're drinking, which you're probably not. Particularly late at night, most of us still lose interest in what we're drinking. We just drink it. Here we are. Right. Okay. Oh, thanks, Inez. Inez passed that one on. There we are. Now, sip of tea. And tonight, of course, we mentioned last week there's a film being shown tonight at the St Kilda Sports Club at 60 Fitzroy Street, Bayview. It's the fight to save Barack Obama, Bayviews for All. Highly praised by people who have seen it. It's free entry, in fact. Isn't that wonderful? Free entry. First in, best dressed. Free entry. And it's tonight at 6 o'clock at the St Kilda Sports Club. The film will start about 6:30. And there's nibbles and drinks available at the bar. It's hosted by Save Public Housing Collective and Care Not Cruelty. And, of course, we know also in that Port Phillip area at the moment, they're trying to throw homeless people off the street and take their belongings off them. So anyway, it gets worse. But in the fight to save Barack Beacon, which I think we all know is a major battle, is on tonight. Bayviews for All, that film tonight. So we urge people to turn up and have a look at that if they haven't seen it. You'll be pleased to know, speaking of people getting into housing and people being thrown out, the homeless being thrown on the street, the very day that Michelle Bullock, the Reserve Bank Governor, announced yet another rate increase, which affects, of course, people with mortgages and people trying to buy houses and everything. That very day, she managed to close out a settlement on a $2 million holiday house in Yamba up in northern New South Wales for herself, which I thought was very nice, wasn't it? It's just lovely to know that she's able to purchase a little house. This is just a holiday house for her and her husband. $2.05 million. Now, just to put that into perspective, the The average house price at the moment, the median house price in Yandra at the moment is $811,000. So 2.05 will be a pretty good little joint up there, I would have thought. It's got its own little glassed-in private cellar, by the way, for your wine, which is lovely, isn't it? It's got everything going for it, really. It's got a granite stone feature wall, an imported French landmark handmade kitchen sink. That'd be worth having. I mean, every time you go up to your kitchen sink and think this is French handmade, you'd feel good about it, wouldn't you? I think so, yeah. And as you wash the wine glass you had from the wine in the cellar. So that's great. But it also, it's just one of her investment properties. She has a property she lives in Sydney, but has a few other investment properties around the place as well. So it's good to know that Michelle's struggling along. And as she says, though, she knows, she said last week when she put the rates up, she said she knows people, it's going to hurt people. But she said it would be worse if inflation took over the fibre, and we still can't work out what that meant, but it must have meant something. But she cares, and in fact, Jim Chalmers, the treasurer, said the same thing. He knew it would hurt people. He said, and he knows people are doing it tough. It's just that he's doing absolutely nothing about it. But there you are. That was that one. Now. Last week, I mentioned a few weeks ago Anthropic, which we know is one of the big AI companies, but at least to their credit, they knocked back an offer, not an offer, an offer you can't refuse, because they did refuse, from the American government, the US government, that they hand over their Oscar, whatever it's called, their particular AI paraphernalia to the military, so the military can use it. And of course the military is desperate to start using all these things where they can kill people at the touch of a hand, and without a human being involved, AI can decide who will live and who will die. Now most of the AI companies have conceded, but they didn't, and this led to Pete Hegseth, the minister, or the secretary for war, to call them a traitor to the US because they wouldn't hand over this information. But of course others have, including OpenAI. And at a post-Oscars party last week, where everyone was having fun, a number of these sort of people turned up as well. And a playwright called Jeremy Harris, I don't know if you know Jeremy Harris or not, but he's an Afro-American playwright. And he bailed up Sam Altman in a corner of the room at this party and said, "I think willfully allowing dangerous technology to be onboarded by society is in of itself evil." And he said he could not ignore Altman willfully allowing his technology to be an agent in global violence. He told Altman, "I don't know how you can comfortably look at yourself in the mirror knowing you just gave your technology over to a department that called itself the Department of War and which just killed 175. I think that really refers to the girls' school in Iran. He said he told the powerful AI executive, "I don't know how you can come to me." I just read that bit, didn't I? I'm stupid. And anyway, but he also went on to say he wants more people to rattle the cages of Silicon Valley overlords who, in his view, are warping society and hurting democracy. "When the scary nerds show up in Prada and Dior," he said, "and want to swan around with the fashionable crowd, they should be shown the exit, not allowed to get cozy in places of culture. I don't think any of them should feel comfortable in that room. I think they should all be really aware of the fact that this is not a room that wants them." He was disappointed that more people weren't challenging Altman and Bezos. Jeff Bezos was there as well. "I'm left thinking, is this my Eartha Kitt Lady Bird Johnson moment?" And that just reminding of that one when in 1968, at a women's luncheon at the White House, Eartha Kitt denounced the Vietnam War to the First Lady and was investigated by the CIA and blacklisted, and Harrah, and I have no idea, Harrah said about the effect of his defiance, there's not too much of it that any of us can do to try to protect right now, because these people are eroding the foundation upon which we stand. So it was quite a good little turn at an Oscars party, having fun. So there you are. But the Eartha Kitt one's interesting, isn't it, as well? That, you know, back in that time, she'd announced, like as people are doing now, to announce the Vietnam War and was blacklisted, which is probably an interesting name, given she was an Afro-American person anyway. Now, of course, anyone who attacks or challenges, well, Trump certainly doesn't like you if you don't agree with him. I think that's fair to say. Meanwhile, while all this is going on in Iran and everywhere else, of course, on the West Bank, the settlers are taking advantage of the situation when they're sort of not quite as much in the news, and unfortunately attacking the Palestinian people in the West Bank more than ever, and getting away with it, killing people, going in and burning cars, burning villages, and of course supported by the Israeli army, and it's just awful that that just keeps going on. But it could be over shortly, I think. The Iran war is, I think, on the verge of being over. And do you know why? No one's coming up with a why? No? Because last week, Anthony Albanese urged them to end the war. Now, that's worked a treat so far. And looks like it's going to be working even better. So it's like all the time when Albanese or Penny Wong or someone come out and say, you know, we urge the parties to do whatever, and the impact they have is enormous, isn't it? And anyway, Anthony says it's time to cease hostilities, and says the original objective of degrading Tehran's nuclear and military capabilities have been achieved. So I think Donald Trump and Benjamin, not another, what's his name, Netanyahu, are all sitting up and listening and saying, well, Anthony's got a point. There you are. Now, here's some bad news, though, on that front. Yeah, seriously bad news. We've agreed to have the Avalon air show again next year, which is basically a military exercise in showing off what you know, all these wonderful planes that can kill people and do wonderful things. And with AI now, I suppose they can just fly around on their own and kill people. I'm just going to top up my tea a fraction. Anyway, how's tea going with people? All going okay, yeah, so thumbs up and everything else. there's a suggestion that some other state might try and pinch it off us, this air show. I mean, how awful. They point out, you know, what it brings to the state. They don't point out what it costs the state to run it, but it does point out what we get back, which is pretty big usually, obviously, because otherwise you wouldn't do it, would you? Because they're all upset that we recently lost the Australian Motorcycle Grand Prix, and you know that's pretty devastating for all of us, of course. The people of Phillip Island are pretty upset, actually, because it does a bit for their economy, I suppose, but why people run around on motorbikes, running sideways and falling off them, I've got no idea. But anyway, that's another question. but anyway, there's a fear, and the opposition is very upset about, you know, the state losing all this stuff. the Avalon Air Show might go somewhere else, so it wouldn't be Avalon Air Show then, would it? It'd be someone else's air show and all that. But you know, I think the fact that we lose something that is a wonderful exhibition where the merchants of death can show off all their wonderful, wonderful paraphernalia and how they kill people, be a tragedy to lose that, I would have thought. We'll see what happens. Also this week, speaking of Donald Trump, Robert Mueller died. He was the former FBI chief, and he's been involved with the American governments for a long, long time. So he's not exactly some mad, incredible radical. But of course, after he retired from the FBI, he got the job of looking at what degree Russia interfered with the election of Bush in the of Trump in the first place in his 2016 election. And Trump from then on didn't like him a lot, even though he came down and said yes, Russia had interfered, but he couldn't have evidence. There was insufficient evidence to show that Trump himself was involved, or there was some criminal conspiracy. But that didn't stop Trump from being a little antagonistic toward him. Mueller died this week at whatever year, whatever age he was, 81. I've got to say, Trump at least, you probably saw the reports, did you? But Trump at least showed, you know, what a decent man he is, that even though they'd fallen out, he just said simply, good, I'm glad he died. He can no longer hurt innocent people. Isn't that wonderful? I'm glad he died. He can no longer hurt innocent people. The innocent person, of course, being guess who? Anyway, even some of his own people thought that was probably not that good. Not that good. Now, one item we had on last week, but we didn't get to because I was going to raise it with Shane McGrath, who comes in and does, but Shane didn't get here last week, and we wondered what happened. One of those situations where a guest falls out. Found out later, this is a terrible thing happened. He simply forgot. Isn't that terrible? Being on City Limits, he simply forgot. Anyway, well, it rang because we were concerned something might have happened to him. But there's a mob called Opal Healthcare, which has 145 homes for older people. And they've decided to make a bit of a change in things. They've now decided that they're going to have a two-tiered structure, where if you pay over and above the normal daily fee and the other fees you pay to get into these places, if you pay an extra $55 a day, which works out at about, at something like 20, there might be a day actually, because it's $20,000 a year. It's a day. You get what you get now, in fact, with things that come now for free, like so-called reasonable food, whatever that means in these places. And you get a hot breakfast, homemade cakes and nightly desserts from the menu. Isn't that wonderful? Telly in your room. You also get a weekly an outing in a bus. You can go up in a bus for an outing. All sorts of wonderful little things you get. Now, if you pay the $55, you get those. But the second tier, if you can't afford the $55, if you happen to be poor, well, bad luck. You get very average food. They unscrew the telly and take it out of your room. That's gone. No trips. Other extras you get. The weekly happy hour, you miss out on the weekly happy hour, whereas $55 you get the weekly happy hour, which would be happy, because you see all the ads, everyone's so happy in these places, so happy that even those who can't afford the $55 and living on the very ordinary food and no sweets and everything else will be happy, because you know they're happy because the ads say they're happy, and that's okay. So Opal thought this was a pretty good idea. And it turned out since that other places are also having these two-tiered structures. One place, in fact, charges you extra if you want air conditioning, for God's sake. You know, it's just on a hot day, probably good. I mean, if you can't afford it, well, bad luck. And if you're an old person, a hot day, well, the room's vacant and get someone else to come in. Once that all that good food they eat, the residue of that good food hit the fan, Opal backed off slightly. They've now agreed that the current residents, even if they can't afford the $55, will keep getting the full thing. But new residents will have to pay the 55 if they want all the extras. So it's pretty good. And I mean, the the ads for these places always had the person, the wonderful, happy, happy person saying, you know, we should have done this years ago. And I think the owners of these places now are saying the same thing. We should have done this years ago and charged them a whole lot more for ripping them off. There was, in fact, an expo last week at here in Melbourne somewhere called the Aged Care Expo or something, where they you could ask questions and find out all these places were having an expo showing what, you know, the wonderful offers they offer you, including, without probably mentioning the extra 55, but the incredible thing about it was, you know what the entry was? Free. You got in for free to learn how they're going to rip you off. I mean, isn't that amazing? I mean, how can they afford it? That's all I can say. How can they afford it? Anyway, now, also, NDIS providers are said to be, because of extra costs and things, are putting up their fees, but their service is not getting any better. And this is a serious one at the moment because the establishment keeps saying, with the government having to, well, they tell us the government has to cut back on spending, but there's certain spending you can't cut back on. We know what that is, the merchants of death, all the corporate welfare that goes to the big business. So you've got to cut back elsewhere, and the NDIS, they keep saying, is getting totally out of hand, and therefore we've got to cut that back. And the government's now agreed, it's actually set up a subcommittee to look at ways of cutting back the NDIS. But the problem with the NDIS, I think, is in terms of if there is problems with spending, that there are, unfortunately, people in the system ripping it off. And that's what you've got to stop. Not cut back on your service to the people with disabilities who need the service. It's a magnificent service. But you've got to cut back on those who are ripping off the system and using it for their own ends. And that needs to be reviewed. And suppose the whole system in that sense needs to be reviewed so that you really do have fully qualified, proper people running doing the services rather than a whole lot of cowboys who seem to have got involved, and that's where major problems occur. But certainly, you know, to take it out on people with disabilities or other people who need government services desperately, while you continue to provide corporate welfare for the super rich. But someone said to me yesterday about how these ads where the mining industry talks about how much its taxes cover more than something that pays for Medibank or pays for Medicare or whatever. But they don't tell you what they get back in corporate welfare. I mean, some of them probably get back more than they actually pay in tax. But they don't mention that in the ad, of course. And why would you? I mean, you're paying for the ad. A bit more tea. Now, this is a very sad story. Big Tobacco, British Tobacco Company, and Big Tobacco are talking about leaving Australia because of this problem with illegal tobacco. Now, wouldn't that be a tragedy if Big Tobacco left the country? Think of all the... Well, probably have some benefit on health, but apart from that, it wouldn't do much for the companies. And I think if you get rid of that and you also actually did clamp down and stop the illegal thing and had no tobacco at all, goodness me, wouldn't that be good? But anyway, there we are. Look, we'll go to Dave Sweeney very shortly, but I noticed that the the ACTU is asking for a 5% wage rise in this year's lowest of low paid case. And I think 5%'s too bloody small, but anyway, they're saying it helps you catch up and all that, and the bosses are saying, well, they've already caught up, haven't they? But you'll be surprised to know, and our old mate Innes Willicks, who's one of our very, very favourites from the Australian Industry Profits Group, you'll be surprised to hear what he said. He said, above inflation wage demands at a time of weak productivity and a global energy crisis could stoke inflation further and prolong economic pain. Now, how selfish the ACTU to put the country in that position. I mean, for God's sake. It is too soon to know the extent and duration of the impact on our economy, but it is beyond doubt strongly to the downside. We are at real risk of stagflation that will send business backwards and weaken household incomes. All parties must take a responsible and careful approach if we are to navigate these waters successfully. I mean, don't realise how bad things are, do you, till you're hearing us? And all parties must be responsible. Well, of course, we know the bosses will be, but it's, you know, what he's really saying there. I mean, clearly that language, he's talking about the bloody unions who are so irresponsible they want a 5% pay rise for the people on the lowest possible pay. So there you are. Meanwhile, of course, Michelle's got her 2.0-something million new little place up at Yamba. And anyway, we'll see where this one goes. But as I said last week, I think on the program, that every time workers ask for a pay rise or something, the bosses are forced to tell us that's not the right time. And I think the simple solution is don't ask for anything until the bosses tell us it is the right time. And that solves the problem, doesn't it? You might never ever get a wage rise, but you'll know that the time wasn't right. It never is. But it will be if they'll tell us. They know. So that seems to me to be the most simple solution. There is a mob. This is an interesting story, actually. There's a mob called Forever New, which says it embraces diversity and inclusion. Another mob called City Chic, and these are high fashion retailers and makers of fashion, and they employ the men, incredibly, get massive amounts more than the women in their workforce, yet they're providing clothes for women. The typical male at these places earns 50% more than the typical female. But they do say, nonetheless, they embrace diversity and inclusion. Imagine if they didn't. For God's sake. Anyway, that's just one I thought I'd throw in. But they can't explain it. They try to explain it, but they can't. It's 9:28. We're going to take a break, come back, and we'll talk to Dave Sweeney and get some sense into this program. Okay, that was Black Man's Right by Bart Willoughby, just fading away there, and we'll get on to Black People's Rights later in the program with Dave Sweeney, who's the uranium campaigner, or anti-uranium campaigner with Australian Conservation Foundation, a regular on this program. And Dave, we'll kick off, we'll get back to that other point later, but kicking off, because at the moment around the world, well, particularly in the Middle East, of course, we're seeing bombs flying around nuclear establishments, and it's a pretty dangerous situation, isn't it?
Yeah, good morning, Kevin. It is deeply dangerous. It's a really, really dangerous, really risky scary, disturbing time. As you say, there are civilian or non-military nuclear facilities being actually targeted and attacked in the Middle East, and there is obviously, you know, the rationale for the attack on Iran is nuclear weapons. That's coming from two nuclear weapon states, with Israel and the US. And there's all this talk about escalating threats about the use of nuclear weapons. So be it attacks and uncontrolled radiation releases from civilian reactors, or be it the conscious use of nuclear weapons, we're at a deeply disturbing time. And some of the key people involved are just extraordinarily cavalier and increasingly unhinged. So, yeah, it is a disturbing time, Kevin.
In fact, here in Australia, there's a mob called the Australian Radiation Protection and Nuclear Safety Agency, PANZA, which says it is actually monitoring and checking our radiation levels here to make sure we don't get affected by what might happen in the Middle East. And they say, let me underline, they say that the situation is very concerning. We cannot rule out a possible radiological release with serious consequences, including the necessity to evacuate areas as large or larger than major cities.
That's exactly where we are. Our ARPANSA, like you said, is our civil nuclear regulator. It's existed since the tail end of the 20th century. And it is part of a group of an international group of national nuclear regulators who share and swap information and use their monitoring systems so that they overlay and effectively cover most of the world for tracking uncontrolled radiation releases. They've got an incident room, which they, you know, in the language of, they stand up at times of crisis. And that's actually here in Melbourne, and it's operative now. And they share their scanning and monitoring information with other regulators and the International Atomic Energy Agency to try and track what's going on. And if people cast their minds back, either, you know, they might remember or it might be ancient history, but when the Chernobyl reactor went up, 1986 in Ukraine, the way the world found out was the Swedish civil nuclear regulator picked up the plume, picked up the radiation, whereas the Soviet authorities didn't say anything for a day or two. So, you know, this is part of like a global check and balance. And I think that when we've got people studying screens in Melbourne about radiation release and impacts, then it's a real question, and it brings literally home to our postcode how interconnected we are and how risky and fraught things are.
Yeah, well, they point out the United Arab Emirates has four operating nuclear reactors. Jordan and Syria have operational nuclear research reactors. Bahrain, Iraq, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar and Saudi Arabia have also been attacked, and these countries all use nuclear applications of some sort or other. We therefore urge utmost restraint in all military operations.
Absolutely. And the IAEA, which is a funny beast because on one hand it is to be the nuclear watchdog. On the other hand, it actively promotes nuclear power and nuclear technology around the world. So it's this split Jekyll and Hyde thing. But the IAEA has been working really hard in the Russia-Ukraine war to try and protect and get some sense around Zaporizhia, which is Europe's largest reactor complex, which has been repeatedly targeted, and it's just by the grace of the goddess and luck that we haven't had a massive contamination event there. And the IAEA has put out quite chilling statements about how serious this is. And what we're seeing now in the Middle East is this increasing and deeply disturbing movement to not see nuclear installations as utterly off limits. They become part of the civilian infrastructure around desalination, water, electricity, power, sewerage, those sort of civil infrastructure elements that are seen increasingly by combatants as a legitimate target, which they're not. And in the case of nuclear, any nuclear facility, you should just put a massive shield around it and not target them, because, you know, you let that genie out of that toxic bottle and it's nothing but heartache all round. So it is really concerning to see this. It's also really concerning to see the resultant breakdown in, you know, the sort of international, you know, overused words, but the international rules, norms, behaviours, that sort of code of conduct. Because we were told in June last year, you remember well, that the US strikes, the Israel strike out of the blue on Iran's enrichment capacity had totally crippled their ability to have enriched uranium and to have nuclear weapons. And yet, you know, 7 months later, that's the full justification for going in to this increasingly complicated, messy, destructive and no end game war. So it's really disturbing that we're seeing this walking away, racing away from trust, talk, treaties, and movement into, you know, might is right, and effectively the Israel or US government positions of, we have this power, we're going to exercise it. What are you going to do about it? That's a deeply disturbing signal to the rest of the world. You know, and it, as a result of this conflict in the Middle East, we've seen, like, you know, France redesign and reposition its nuclear posture, Kevin. It's increasing significantly its nuclear capacity and putting that as a European nuclear shield in the absence of unreliability of Trump. And we're seeing this sort of breakout and this normalisation of talk about nuclear weapons and this normalisation of that it's okay to attack nuclear facilities. And neither of those things are in any way okay for our species or the planet.
Yeah, and of course, responsibility in the hands of Trump, Netanyahu and the theocratic lot in Iran doesn't give you much confidence, does it?
No, not at all. You know, all three in their own way believe they're on the bus, they got the front row seats to whatever sort of afterlife they're assured to get. So that's a deeply disturbing thing when you bring in, like, the military capacity to cause global annihilation coupled with an autocratic approach that believes they have a divine right and will have a divine privilege and has fewer and fewer checks and balances, fewer and fewer adults in the room. It's not a good time, and it's a really important time then for countries like ours to step up and speak with absolute clarity, conviction, and unequivocally for non-violent, non-military, diplomatic solutions, but always advocating for approaches that do not escalate tensions and do not target civilians.
Yeah, and of course, in the meantime, well, back in February, the new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, or New START, which was an agreement between Russia and the US to sort of sit on where they were, basically, has expired and not been renewed. So they are now free to develop more and more nuclear weapons.
It's the first time for 50 years, Kevin, that there has been not one instrument of constraint between the two major nuclear powers. So between Russia and the US, they hold over 90% of the nuclear weapons in the world. And there has at least been a sort of holding of the status quo, like you say. But the start of February, New START expired. No attempt from the Trump government, despite an offer from the Russians to just roll it over as is for 12 months till we talk about it. No attempt from the US to accept that. They just said, it's over. So now we're seeing no constraints on the deployability, the number, the location and targeting status of 90% plus of the world's nuclear weapons. And that's in the realm then of Putin and Trump. Both are engaged in illegal wars, and it is really deeply disturbing that the absence of New START is fueling elevated uncertainty. And in uncertainty, people who are fearful and uncertain make decisions which are not generous, which are not good. And we're seeing that ripple effect go out globally. We're seeing it here too, because with the AUKUS deal, that not only means nuclear submarines, but it also means the permanent deployment of six US B-52 long-range bombers at RAAF Tyndall Base, near Katherine in the territory. And those bombers, like half the US B-52 fleet under the New START agreement, could not be nuclear armed. They were not to be. And one of the arguments that different people were making to the Australian government was, this is a bad idea and shouldn't happen, but the default position is, if it's going to happen, only planes from that 50% cohort that can't be nuclear armed, should be in Australian airspace or based here. That's gone now. So the whole box and dice has changed, and the same with submarines. Submarines in the US are being retrofitted to carry nuclear weapons. So that means we are being tractor beamed into increasing complicity, engagement, interoperability, interchangeability with the US, and less sovereignty in our decision making. Yesterday, the US Chief of Naval Operations was in Perth, Kevin, Admiral Darrell Caudle. He was in Perth. He toured HMAS Stirling, where we've spent or are spending $8 billion making it good for US subs, which will arrive five in effectively permanent rotation from next year. And he said that there is an implicit expectation that Australia will be lockstep in military operations with the US, and he called AUKUS a match made in heaven. Now, I'm not sure what sort of deity or what sort of heaven is his definition, but it is not shared by me and many others, and it is tractor beaming Australia to increased interdependence and enabling of nuclear weapons. So those sort of things are really important. There's a real push now ahead of the ALP National Conference at the end of July in Adelaide this year, and ahead of other things, lots of civil society groups, groups like ICAN, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, lots of civil society groups from environment groups like ACF and Friends of the Earth right through to all sorts of groups are saying very loudly and clearly there needs to be a red line on nuclear weapons. Australians need to know, and Australians need to have the ability to say no. We can't just drift because of secrecy and the sort of Penny Wong, Richard Miles line of we don't comment on operational issues. We can't let our country be tractor beamed into acceptance, enabling facilitation of illegal weapons of mass and indiscriminate destruction that threaten life of our species and all species on this beautiful, shared, fragile planet. Not too much to ask, but we're asking it, we're urging it, we're pleading for it, and we're demanding it, because it's deeply disturbing times, and we need clear responses from countries. You know, as they say middle power, or, you know, smaller progressives or whatever, however you want to call it. For all the flaws, countries like Australia have a really important role to speak some reason, to speak about peace, to speak about real shared values of equity, a habitable planet, and, you know, non-violent solutions. War should always be the last resort, not the first option.
Yeah, the difference between heaven and hell, obviously. Well, his heaven is obviously other people's hell, unfortunately. Dave, also Australia, of course, still hasn't signed the UN treaty against weapons that was brought in by the group you're involved with, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. Australia's still on the outside. Oh. Yeah. Back again, I think, Dave. Sorry about that, but I was saying that Australia still hasn't signed the UN anti-nuclear treaty, which was brought in by the group you're involved with, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. We're still on the outside.
Yeah, we are. I thought when you were phrasing that question and the phone went dead, I thought they'd finally had enough of you, Kevin.
I didn't hear the click, so it wasn't Asia this time.
I'm glad to be back. Yeah, look, so the treaty, the international treaty, the UN treaty for the abolition of nuclear weapons, or prohibition of nuclear weapons, is the like it's the one bright light, you know. They say a candle's brightest when the sky's darkest, and that's the brightest light now. Like Newstart, like we were saying, is gone. All those checks and balances are going. There's increasing normalisation of the horror of nuclear. And yet at the same time, there's this international instrument which says quite beautifully, really clearly, really powerfully, these things are right out of order and must go. And now the good news is that fully half the world is now signed on. Half the nations in the world are signed on, fully committed to and formally committed to advancing this treaty. The other good news is in our local neck of the woods, now half the Australian Federal Parliament has signed personal pledges saying that they support and will work to advance this treaty. So half of our Parliament has done that. It has been part of ALP national platform since 2018. So that's long enough now, and it's time now to turn that welcome commitment into an actual reality and for Australia to step up and sign. So Australia hasn't signed. Australia has made a few modest steps under Labor and sent like a parliamentary observer to meetings, has made some good supportive statements, has moved votes in the UN from opposed to abstain. So they're sort of positive things, but they're nowhere near the extent or the boldness or the clarity or the speed that we need. Like, we're racing into AUKUS and we're very slow walking, one forward, one back, and then hold your position into signing this treaty and advancing and operationalising this treaty. So that's a real focus for ICANN and others, as you can imagine, and also for a lot of trade unions, Kevin, ahead of the ALP conference. It's like, you know, Anthony Albanese, you drove this in 2018, you championed it into platform. You said signing this treaty would be Labor at its best. You said it won't be easy, but it's just and it's essential. Now, it's 8 years later, so pick up a pen and sign and really put that flag in the sand, particularly given AUKUS. So there's an elevated effort. You know, one thing is that about our species that's great is when you get elevated madness, you also get people increasingly stepping up to say no or to offer alternatives. And that's happening in this space. And there's a real contest of ideas and values over the next few months. Now, that conference isn't the be-all and end-all, but obviously it's a really big moment. And there's a whole range of groups, and ICANN is coordinating and working with civil society groups and is in the midst of a national roundtable meeting trade unions, civil society groups, state and local politicians, is doing strong advocacy in Canberra, really trying to elevate this issue. And it really is, sometimes it's like, you know, a bit of a Sisyphus, you're pushing that rock up the hill and all that, but it is really important. There are really positive things to see half our parliament signed on, to see half our planet signed on. These things are growing. And it is really important. And like I say, it's something that offers an antidote to despair because, you know, if you look around and you look at the state of the world and then you look at the power of respective players, like individual people versus nuclear weapon states, it's easy to feel really disempowered. That's understandable, but feeling disempowered, the only one it empowers is the one who's risking the planet. So we've got to keep, it's an act of revolutionary act to have a bit of hope, humour and humanity at the moment. And the treaty offers a little bit of a pond, a bit of a pool we can draw from to replenish and keep going and to push that at least we make our country take a stand that says we do not want to be involved with these weapons. They're vile, they're indiscriminate, they're the weapons of absolute unmitigated terror, and we're not going to touch them. That's not too much to ask, and that's what we're asking for.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure how difficult it is to pick up a pen and sign something, actually. But, Dave, we'll move on because the Jabiluka mine for a long time has been agreed that it won't proceed. Rio Tinto agrees with the, or has got conformed anyway, with the wishes of the Mirarr local indigenous people who say that mine in the Northern Territory should never reopen. And yet there's a move on in court at the moment to try and have it reopened. What's going on?
Yeah, you are so on the money because it was actually Monday of this week that was the anniversary of the start of the Jabiluka blockade, which was a massive civil disobedience blockade which helped halt that mine and really showed strong support for Mirarr traditional owners' aspirations that there be no further uranium mining on their country in Kakadu. So what's happening is that because of that blockade and then the takeover of the company Energy Resources Australia, or the purchase of two-thirds of it by Rio Tinto, in the early parts of this century, there was basically a sort of standoff agreement in part made, and it was formalised, and it was like the company Rio said, look, ERA control Rio said, we won't push ahead with Jabiluka, and you just back off and don't try and take away the lease. So it was sort of like this frozen moment. And it continued like that for a while, but now the politics has evolved that people fully understand that Mirarr are absolutely red hot, dead set, certain we will never give a consent to this mine. Things have moved on. The whole project now, the project economics don't figure up. It has no approvals, et cetera, et cetera. So Rio Tinto have made a virtue of necessity and said, we're not going to do this. We're going to clean up and exit. That's to their credit. And what's happened is a couple of minority shareholders in Energy Resources of Australia, who always had big hopes for a nuclear-propelled future, which would make them incredibly rich, are deeply discontented that the project will not go ahead, and had taken federal court action against Rio Tinto seeking to compulsorily acquire ERA. Rio has got overwhelming lion's share, but it wanted to mop up the last couple of percent and make it a fully owned Rio unit that Rio could then direct. The independent or minority shareholders were very hostile to this. They saw this as their atomic dream drying up and took federal court action, saying that the terms were unfair, that the process was unfair, that they'd been denied natural procedural justice, etc. Rio made the case that, look, we own 98% of the show, 96-98% of the show. We've done all the analysis. It doesn't stack up. It's our call. We're not doing it. So that's basically, like, you know, if you're on a pleasers, it was much more than that, but that's the guts of what was going on. So now the federal court has gone away to make its consideration of the merits of that case. But what we're basically looking at is a rearguard action from a couple of vexatious, disgruntled minority shareholders who feel personally aggrieved and ideologically compelled versus one of the world's biggest mining companies who has made a pretty hard-headed assessment based on all those crunching, all those things of dollars, numbers, politics, resources, other spends, and came up with the best thing we can do for Rio Tinto, not just for the Mirarr, but for Rio Tinto, is to keep our promise to clean up Ranger, the existing or the former mine, and to not advance Jabiluka. And it's going to be a big enough job that costs over $2 billion to clean up the Ranger mine, heavily contaminated in a dual World Heritage listed region, and a real test post-Juukan Gorge of Rio Tinto's corporate responsibility. Are they unbridled robber barons, or do they have a shred of longer-term thinking? And that's on test in Kakadu, and they know that, and they're doing, to their credit, the right thing at this point in time. And we really hope to see the federal court says this company is now Rio Tinto's, and Rio Tinto then move on to speedily move to go, okay, never be Jabiluka, absolutely will clean up Ranger, sorry for the mess, see you later, and keep a watching brief on that rehabilitation program, but effectively exit responsibly that Kakadu region, which should never have been mined, and because of the actions of the Mirarr people and their many supporters, you know, is increasingly looking like we're heading the right way. It's a nuclear story where we're heading the right way. That's another bright light.
We've only got a minute left, Dave, but one of the extraordinary arguments they're putting up in court is that if the ownership were to change, then the Mirarr people's objection would become null and void. That's a pretty extraordinary argument, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an extraordinary extraordinary argument, and it's completely doesn't capture the reality of the story. And MIRR have been consistently, always opposed to uranium mining on their country, and they have been and led the fight against Jabiluka. That is not changing, and this is like a sign of increasing speculation, desperation from people who have made a bet and their pony hasn't come home, and now they're crying unfair.
Yeah, OK, look, thanks for that. And we've run out of time, Dave. We could have gone on forever, I think, on this one. But, I suppose we're still waiting. We don't know when they're going to bring that decision down.
No, they don't give us any sense of that at all. Like, I hope it's positive and swift, and we just have to wait and keep focused and keep working and keep positive. And MIRR aren't going anywhere, and their position is not changing. So those of us, many of us who support that, need to, you know, hold our fire and keep that, and keep Rio Tinto reminded of what their responsibilities are and what's at stake here. They'll be closely watched and long judged on how they perform.
Good. Okay. We'll keep an eye on it. Dave, thanks for that. We'll talk to you again, but thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks for the opportunity. Good to talk, Evan.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Dave Sweeney there for the Australian Conservation Foundation. And that's it. We've got Joe coming up with Anarchist World this week. And thanks to, well, in fact, Antimony and Inez today for keeping us on air and doing wonderful things. And next week it's transport. It's the first worst Wednesday of the month, transport. Okay, that's it.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.